How do you do? Jen and Cam feel it would be unkind to present this program without a friendly word of warning. We are about to unfold our true crime podcast, a podcast of lifelong friends who seek to examine crimes which were committed without reckoning upon God. The discussion will be frank, and the subject matter will be of a grim and violent nature. I think it will thrill you. It might even horrify you. So, if there are young children listening, or if you feel unwilling to subject your nerves to such a strain, now is your chance to... Well, we've warned you.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam. It's good to hear your voice.
Long time no pod.
I know.
How are you?
Been a little bit busy, have you? Been good.
Just a little busy.
Yeah.
I moved.
For those.
Yeah.
Yes.
There you go. I moved, and it's the most terrible thing I've ever done in my whole life, and I'm never going to move ever again. Ever. Sort of.
Well, you had to move out in 3 weeks, so you really pushed it.
I did.
You did a great job, by the way.
Gave away almost all my belongings. So that's okay. Whatever, right? Onward and upward.
You can always get new.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see about that. It'll be okay. I'm just glad to be back. Glad to have a little bit of normalcy back in my life. Never thought I'd say that, but excited to go to work and excited to podcast and be back like normal-ish. So yeah, but everybody out there, thank you. Sorry for the long delay. And I appreciate the kindness of you guys. I mean,
everybody was very nice checking in on us and everything.
Yeah. So very,
it was great. Very we sweet. Appreciate
yes,
you.
We do. We really do. It makes it all worth it. I know it's a small thing that somebody writes a nice review or drops us a nice little line saying that they like us, because then you're like, okay, you know, makes it all worth it.
It's nice. Makes all the haters
it really
go
does.
Away.
And so. For the record, buddy, if you're listening, I've never once listened to Morbid. Just saying. I haven't. I really haven't. Morbidology with Emily, but never Morbid. Not once have I listened to it.
Sure. For those of you that don't know, we broke some man by the name of Ronald, but that's okay. We'll go on.
Or just a blatant attempt at Morbid, although, like I said, never even heard of them. Well, I've never listened to them. I have heard of them.
We started immediately after all of them. So I've spoken with Ash a few times on a podcast thread, but that's about it.
Yeah.
So anyway.
I'd wish them all the I wish them well.
Yeah.
And if we're,
we've heard great things about them.
For a poor man's Morbid, I would say that we're doing okay. So there you go. So I'll take it. You tried to insult us, but I think in a way it's kind of a compliment.
Except for the man part. We are poor, so that works.
Yeah. So yeah. Jen, I heard you have an episode for us.
I do. Are you ready?
I'm so ready. Hit me.
At around 8:30 a.m. on Sunday, August 26, 2012, Mark Bretz was making his way home after delivering cows at a local meat market. It was a beautiful morning, and he was looking forward to getting back to his family so they could all head to church. As he was continuing along Ohio Route 208, passing through the remote, grassy intersection of Keys and Steel Hill Roads, he noticed something laying in the middle of the road. At first, he assumed it was an animal and prepared himself to swerve around it. But it was only as he got closer that he realized it was a body of a woman. As Mark slowed his truck and approached the woman picked herself up and threw herself at his truck.
Oh.
She was begging for help, screaming that someone was trying to kill her. Mark couldn't believe what he was seeing. Her skin was so severely burned. It was hanging off of her body. Her hair was gone, and she was covered in scratches from dragging herself a quarter of a mile through branches and undergrowth. As he got out of his truck, he caught her in his arms and started promising her that everything would be okay. He laid her down in the grass, gave her a blanket to cover her naked body, and tilted her head back to help her drink. As he did, he noticed a strap wrapped tightly around her neck that had burned into her skin. Mark loosened it in an attempt to help the woman breathe, and then he placed his first call to 911 at 8:34 a.m. The woman was crying in agony and didn't understand why her temperature was so high. Mark told her that she was severely burned and assured her that help was on its way. She told Mark that she knew she was going to be ugly, and he replied, telling her she was beautiful now and forever.
Aww.
Mark sounds like an amazing
man. Right?
As she continued to scream, pleading for morphine, Mark began to grow restless, waiting for the police. As the woman struggled to stay alive, every passing minute felt like an hour. Mark began to grow restless, waiting for the police, as the woman continued to plead for drugs.
Ugh.
To ease the pain. So he decided to make a second call to 911 at 8:41 a.m.
Why were they taking so long?
They were way far out in the country.
Okay.
The woman begged Mark not to leave her as they waited for help to arrive. Mark held her hand and told her that he wasn't going to go anywhere. Mark prayed over Chelsea, saying, quote, "Open up the pearly gates, let the angels take her and make her better." Chelsea thanked him for the prayer.
Mm.
He continued to ask the woman questions, partly to give the police as much information as he could, but also to help the woman stay conscious. He asked her if she knew her name, and she told him that she was Celeste Fronsman, 29 years old, from Canton, Ohio. In her 29 years, Celeste had a troubling life and faced many hardships. She had begun taking drugs to deal with her emotional pain, and to be able to afford these drugs, she had begun to take part in sex work, both of which had led to many arrests in recent years. She was stuck in an endless cycle in which she couldn't see a way out. And of course, the media reported heavily on Celeste's criminal history, the drug use, and they would air the many mugshots taken in police custody. Many failed to report that Celeste was a human being who had a loving family with tons of friends that adored her. Celeste kept in touch with her family as much as possible, always telling them how much she loved them. She had beautiful dark eyes and long hair, which she was proud of. She loved listening to R&B music and dressing up with her sister. In 2002, Celeste gave birth to a daughter by the name of Jordan. Celeste was such a proud and loving mother. But unfortunately, in 2005, when Jordan was just 2 years old, she passed away following a lung condition that was present since birth.
Mm.
Just 4 years later, Celeste's mother, Deborah, passed away with heart issues. Both of these deaths destroyed Celeste, and she found it extremely difficult to cope. Her sister, Sarah, is quoted saying, quote, "When her daughter died, that brought her down. And then when mom died, she had another setback. The devil made her do things she knew she shouldn't. We always told her she needed to stop what she was doing and ask God for forgiveness. It just means so much to us that the man who found her prayed with her." As children, the pair would play, fight, and argue like siblings do, but they were still extremely close. And Celeste was an awesome aunt to Sarah's children. Celeste never lost who she was. She was a kind and caring person who always looked out for those she loved. Now, how Celeste Foreman ended up 79 miles from her home city at the side of the road, with fourth-degree burns over most of her body, is still a total mystery. Mark was asking her questions, but finding it extremely difficult to understand Celeste through her agonizing cries.
Mm.
In total, she and Mark waited for around 20 minutes for the Adamsville Volunteer Fire Department and the emergency services to arrive. The paramedics attempted to place Celeste on a stretcher, but she was so burnt they were afraid of hurting her. Celeste used the last of her strength to lift herself off the ground and put herself on the stretcher.
Ugh.
She wanted so desperately to survive, and she fought until the very end. Horrible. I could not
imagine.
I was
hoping she was going to make it. I think that has to be one of the worst ways to die. Most painful.
I agree. Mark said that everyone who arrived at the scene that day treated her with the utmost respect and was so very kind to her, despite the horrific injuries that they were all witnessing for the very first time. Mark Bretz continued to hold her hand while she waited inside the ambulance, still reassuring her that she would be taken care of. As Celeste was transferred by MedFlight to the hospital, the detectives combed the area for any clues. She had borrowed her father's truck on Friday, 2 days before she appeared on the road, and the vehicle still hadn't been located. Around a quarter of a mile away, they found the scene where they believed that Celeste had been set on fire and collected as much evidence as possible. When the media would ask Sheriff Mark Lutz for any details, he remained tight-lipped about the investigation, but asked anyone with any information to come forward to help. On Tuesday, August 28th, 2012, 29-year-old Celeste was sadly taken off the ventilator at the Wexner Medical Center in Columbus. She was surrounded by family who held her hand as she passed away. Everyone who knew her was devastated, and they still struggle to comprehend that she is no longer alive. Poor baby. Her death was immediately ruled a homicide by the Franklin County Coroner's Office. Celeste had suffered fourth-degree burns across 70% of her body. The detectives suspected that her autopsy could take up to a month to complete because of the severe nature of her injuries. Now, if you want to know a little bit about fourth-degree burns go through both layers of the skin and the underlying tissues, as well as deeper tissues, possibly involving the muscle and the bone. There is no feeling in the area since all the nerve endings are destroyed.
Unbelievable.
Don't even want to imagine that.
Me neither.
Following her death, Mark Bruntz returned to the area where he had found Celeste, placing a wooden cross, a piece of the blanket that he had used to wrap her in, and the Gatorade bottle that she had drank out of. He laid down purple and yellow flowers and a letter that he had pinned to Celeste, writing that he was so grateful he got to meet her that day. Telling you.
That would be something.
Good man.
So that would be very hard for him as well to.
You'd have PTSD.
You really would.
You'd never get over it. And God love him. I mean, he. Telling you. Now, at this point, investigators hadn't yet disclosed that Celeste had named her attackers in her final moments. A heroic action that led to the unraveling of a deeply disturbing case that still troubles investigators to this day.
Good.
Less than a week later, in September of 2012, three people who Celeste trusted and thought were her friends were indicted for her murder. 20-year-old Katrina Culberson, 24-year-old Monica Washington, and 33-year-old LaFonz Dixon. They were all charged with aggravated murder, aggravated arson, and one count of kidnapping. All three faced the death penalty and were held on a $5 million bond at the Muskegon County Jail. The trio pleaded not guilty. Of course they did. They admitted to being drug users and that they had been in trouble with the law, but they insisted that they had nothing to do with Celeste's death.
Celeste, their friend.
Celeste, their friend. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. As the suspects awaited court proceedings, Katrina Culbertson and LaFaz Dixon conducted jailhouse interviews with the Times Recorder newspaper. This is when Katrina Culbertson began to open up about her version of the events. She spoke to reporters claiming, quote, "Being addicted to crack has led me from one bad thing to another. I beat it once and then slipped, and now I'm here." The Times Recorder states that Katrina's drug addiction began when she was just a teenager. She had fallen pregnant at age 14 and lost custody of her daughter 3 years later when she was 17. She too had begun sex work as a means to fund her growing addiction to heroin and cocaine. And it was through sex work that she met Celeste in a similar situation. Katrina claimed Celeste was wearing dirty sweatpants and a hoodie that she had worn for several consecutive days, and Katrina had taken it upon herself to buy Celeste some new clothes and a phone to help her out. Celeste was completely vulnerable and alone. No doubt that these gestures were an attempt to take advantage of her, whether it be for acquiring drugs or money. Katrina was known by police for acquiring friends in this way. She often arranged sex work under the premise of kindness before threatening them and stealing the majority of their earnings. Katrina says that she would arrange sex for Celeste via the internet as opposed to standing on the street, and that the pair relied on each other over the months for comfort. Finally, she admitted culpability in the crime, stating, quote, "All I'm saying is that we all had part in it, but drugs make you do dumb things. They make you numb. And it's not even you doing them. I may do gangster things, but I'm not a gangster. I'm a girly girl."
That's what she said.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can be a girly girl
that sets her friends on fire. Yeah, thank you.
I was going to say, you can be a girly girl and do drugs and be a sex worker.
Girly girl and be a sex worker, yeah.
But killing your friend?
That's okay. No girly girl stuff. No.
Mm-mm.
Katrina struggled to adapt to life behind bars. She reflected on a period of her life where she was sober, working with children in a healthcare center. She said she spent every day pacing the floor and crying in her cell. She believes she is, quote, too cute for prison and is filled with loneliness and regret. Honey.
What? Too cute for prison?
Too cute for prison. Mm-hmm. But not too cute, girly girl, to set your friend on fire.
There's just no words for people like that. I think she's exactly where she should be. And you know
I
what?
I hate her already. I mean, whether she's guilty or... she's guilty. Don't get me wrong. But I hate her.
Well, I hope she's popular in the pokey. Let's put it that way. Since she's so cute, she probably is.
She's too cute. She's a too cute girly girl. Whatever, Katrina. Sure. Those that preach about it sure as hell aren't.
That is true. If you have to announce it, probably
it's not true.
Yeah, you're probably not that cute.
LaFonce and Katrina had met 3 years ago at a New Year's Eve party. Despite the 13-year-old age difference, Katrina being just 17 at the time the two started dating, they believed that they were soulmates who had been brought together by God. Now, despite Katrina's admission, LaFonce would not admit to any involvement in the crime. He insisted he was only a drug dealer trying to sell drugs and be with his family. He says, quote, I watched my sister die in a house fire when I was young, and I'd never do anything like that to someone. I'm not a violent person. I'm a lover and a father. I just want to be out there to be able to go home to my three boys and family with my girly girl, too cute for prison girl, Katrina. People can be so frustrating, these people. He also claims that he only ever helped Celeste Fronsman by giving her money to buy drugs or a place to stay. He shifted the blame entirely to his girlfriend, Katrina, saying that he knew she was with Celeste the day before she appeared in the middle of the road. He said, quote, I need people to know I'm not in any way capable of doing something like this, especially to a female. He ended his interview by saying that if Katrina is to blame, he will be there for her.
Mm-hmm.
What a man.
They in love, Jen. They in the L-O-V-E. Love.
But Daddy, I love him. As the evidence began to mount, Katrina Culbertson knew the possibility of her receiving the death penalty was growing rapidly. Something she admitted that she was afraid of. They all are, aren't they?
They weren't afraid of it when they were setting that poor little girl on fire. Okay, no. Go ahead.
On the 26th of September 2012, she decided to take a plea agreement, finally admitting her guilt. The conditions were that she had to testify against Monica and LaFonce, assisting authorities as much as possible in their investigation. The plea agreement also meant that the death penalty was now off the table and Katrina would now face life in prison instead. As this news was released to the media, two of Celeste's close friends, Frank Vaughns and Howard Cameron, gave an entirely different perspective to the relationship between Celeste and Katrina. Due to the troubling lifestyle they both shared, Celeste relied heavily on Katrina, and Katrina used this to manipulate and control Celeste as much as possible. Frank and Howard said Katrina abused Celeste until the very end, persistently giving her black eyes, physically assaulting her, and threatening to kill her on numerous occasions.
Mm.
Howard Kamen said, quote, Katrina even came to my house looking for Celeste the week before they took her. She was running all over my house screaming for Celeste. The woman wanted to control Celeste in every way, and Celeste thought that they were friends. So the worst kind of people, I'm telling you.
They really are.
Howard said Celeste would often go to his house to get sober and sleep, but that Katrina would always appear and persuade Celeste to go back with her. Frank Vaughns only had two words to describe Katrina. And those words are pure evil. I don't see him mentioning too cute or girly girl. I think pure evil.
I think that sums it up a little bit better than girly girl.
Yeah.
Or too cute.
Or too cute. 6 months later, 24-year-old Monica Washington followed in Katrina's footsteps and also pleaded guilty to aggravated murder, aggravated arson and kidnapping. She too avoided the death penalty by changing her plea. Both Monica and Katrina had to await the outcome of LaFonce Dixon's trial before they received their sentences for their involvement in Celeste's murder. As the months passed, LaFonce continued to plead his innocence, claiming he had been framed by Monica and Katrina, because of course he did. He refused to accept responsibility despite knowing that his two accomplices were preparing to testify against him. Now, the following information was found in archived newspapers, particularly the Zanesville Times-Recorder. Journalist Hannah Sparling did a fantastic job of extensively reporting each day as it unfolded. LaFonce Dixon trial finally began on Tuesday, October 8th, 2013, at the Muskegon Court Common Pleas Court. The case was presented in front of 12 jurors and the presiding judge, Kelly Cottrell. I think that's C-O-T-T-R-I-L-L. Your Cottrell? Honor, if that's wrong, I apology. Again, LaFonce continued his plea of not guilty. Immediately, the 12 jurors were taken to the area where Celeste had been set on fire, and then traveled the path she had crawled to the road in a desperate attempt to salvation. That breaks my heart every time I read it. I get a pit in my chest.
It's that human will to survive.
But and it's just
awful. But thank goodness she lasted long enough to rat them out.
And thank goodness Mark was there to help her through it. I mean, she needed somebody as kind as Mark to be with her and calm her and pray with her and seriously, I get goosebumps when I think about it. All 12 were then shown images of Celeste's body covered in burns that were taken during the ambulance journey and then after her death in the morgue. Prosecutors Ron Welch and Michael Haddix then explained the horrific ordeal that Celeste went through that day, including the prolonged, brutal attack that her friends inflicted on her before she was set on fire. They expressed their intent to prove that LaFonce was just as culpable as Katrina Culbertson and Monica Washington, both of which had already implicated him in the crime. As part of their opening statement, the prosecution informed the jurors of key pieces of evidence that they were going to hear in the oncoming days, such as LaFonce Dixon's DNA on the scotch tape used to bind Celeste's hands, and the chances of the DNA belonging to anyone rather than LaFonce was 1 in 11,750. Now, I'm not good at math, but that sounds like, you know,
that's
pretty
a lot.
Slim odds. They also heard that LaFonce's phone had disappeared from the network hours before Celeste's murder, either through being out of service or being turned off, which suggested premeditation.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the jury heard that Katrina had written a letter to LaFonce while in jail, one of which said, quote, "I lied. You'll be out soon." Never put it in writing, Mrs. Too Cute, Pure Evil.
You know, they always do. They always do. They always just do stupid stuff like that. Or they're going to tell their new best friend, their Sally, that they've known for weeks or days.
And also for the first time during the trial, the jurors heard the motive behind the vicious attacks. Around 2 weeks before Celeste was killed, one of LaFonce's drug houses had been raided by police, and he immediately suspected Celeste was the one that had given the police information. Then, just days before the murder, a stranger had driven Celeste to the police station so she could escape LaFonce. LaFonce followed the stranger in his car, and after seeing Celeste enter the police station, he became certain that Celeste was a police informant. And that's when they decided to kill her. Larry Thomas and Isabella Dixon began their opening statements for the defense by demanding the jury listen closely to the evidence and put all emotion aside. Isabella stated, quote, "And you're going to hear that it was Katrina who poured that gasoline. And you're going to hear that it was Katrina who lit that match. You're going to hear that it was Katrina who knew about this area." They believed their key to proving LaFonce's evidence was Celeste herself. When Celeste was found dying in the road, she named Katrina Culberson and the initials KC, which Katrina often went by. According to the defense, she did not mention LaFonce because he wasn't there. The defense called Sheriff Deputy Gary Hargreaves, the first to arrive on the scene, to the stand. There, he clarified that the only name Mark Bruntz had written down after speaking to Celeste was Katrina's. Towards the end of the first day, the court heard testimony from Larry Jones, a burn specialist from the Wexler Medical Center in Ohio. He claimed that Celeste Franzman's burns were, quote, one of the worst, if not the worst, he had ever treated, and that she never would have survived because of the extensive damage to her skin, and it was too severe to graft. Her face was one of the least affected areas of her body, displaying bruises around her left eye. Although other injuries were visible, he stated that the fluids they used to treat her wounds may have covered any other trauma on her body from the attack before the fire. There were also lighter brown circles on the surface of her skin, and those were the result of ruptured blisters due to the extreme heat. Jesus. It's horrible. Until day two of the trial, the true details of Celeste Franzman's attack were relatively unknown. When Katrina Culberson took the stand to testify against LaFons, she left everyone in the courtroom horrified. Katrina explained that she and LaFons were angry at Celeste in the days leading up to the murder, mainly because of the drug raid at LaFons' house, but also because Celeste owed Katrina money. She said Celeste had snitched on several drug dealers in the area because she was so scared of the police. Days before her murder, Katrina and LaFons had taken Celeste to a friend's house and confronted her about snitching. Celeste denied it and managed to escape the house. And in the court documents, I'm just going to say, this house is known as Old Hooker Alice's house. Just saying.
Okay, I can picture it.
Katrina and LaFons were certain that Celeste was going to go to the police and began discussing how they could kill her. Yeah. Now, this is going to get even more graphic, and my apologies, but just so you know. In the early hours of August 26th, the day of Celeste's murder, Katrina traveled to her friend Bobby's house to buy crack cocaine. At the house, she found Monica Washington asleep. She kissed Monica on the head before showing her the bag of cocaine. Katrina asked Monica to go with her for a drive, and Monica quickly agreed. As they were driving around Canton, Ohio, they spotted Celeste in her father's truck and began chasing her, eventually catching up with her at the Walmart parking lot where Katrina, and that's where Katrina approached her. Now, Katrina promised she wasn't going to hurt Celeste and instead had secured her a $900 date that they would both go on together.
Mm-hmm.
Celeste believed them and she got inside the SUV that the pair were traveling in. Now, unbeknownst to Celeste, Katrina had activated the child locks on the back door of the car, so Celeste couldn't escape at all.
Mm.
Katrina then picked up LaFons. She said there wasn't any real plan in place, but that she and LaFons shared a look. And at that moment, she knew, quote, it was on.
Nice.
Katrina began to drive as LaFons and Monica took turns hitting Celeste in the face. She said Celeste screamed initially, but then sat there staring blankly, not saying a word, as they continued to assault her.
She's probably in shock. Like, what are you doing?
Or just praying inside her head that it's not going to go the way she thinks it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Katrina circled Canton in the car for around 20 minutes before merging onto Interstate 77 South. The attack on Celeste continued as the four of them traveled. They bound her wrist with tape and a belt before stuffing napkins into her mouth and tying a t-shirt around her face. Katrina said she then climbed into the back of the car and hit Celeste multiple times with a handle of a screwdriver and began kneeling on her neck until blood started rushing out one of her eyes.
Mm.
Poor baby. LaFons then got a black belt and some masking tape out of the back of the car and wrapped it around Celeste's neck, choking her until she turned blue. Celeste tried to fight back but was trapped under all three, unable to move. This abuse continued for hours, and after trying and failing to locate a secluded spot, they stopped at the Tri-County Recreation Area in Muskegon County. They dragged poor Celeste out of the car and laid her on the tall grass. Celeste was bound and unable to see or move. The trio poured gasoline over her body, and then Katrina set her alight. The three gathered as much evidence as they could before driving away, leaving Celeste burning and completely alone. The defense immediately began poking holes in Katrina's version of events by pointing out the fact that she had lied on numerous occasions in the initial days following her arrest. Katrina first claimed that she, Monica, and LaFonce had nothing to do with the crime at all before eventually changing her story. Larry Thomas, the defense attorney, said, quote, "You were in control of this vehicle, and you were taking the vehicle to where you wanted to go." He asked her, quote, "Who got the gas out of the truck? Who poured the gas? Who put the gas in the back? Who lit the gas?" Katrina answered, quote, "I did," to all four questions.
Mm-mm. See ya.
Doesn't matter. He's still there. He could stop it. He could have done...
Right? I
frustrated.
I
Katrina told the court that she and Celeste had met through drugs and sex work, claiming that they smoked a lot of cocaine and went on dates together. According to Katrina, she and Celeste had become lovers, but she admitted that Celeste was terrified of her. Katrina says Celeste would do everything she told her to out of fear of being beaten up. That's not a relationship.
Yeah, I know.
She admitted to beating up Celeste regularly, usually over money that was owed. Katrina concluded her testimony by telling the jurors about her lack of love for LaFonce Dixon and how that has become clear that since she's sobered up. Quote, "When I was smoking crack, you don't really love anybody. You love crack. I had feelings for him, but I wouldn't say I genuinely loved him. I really changed since this happened." I should hope so. "I look back and I know what I did was wrong, and I deserve to be punished along with everyone else. I don't feel like I betrayed him at all. I feel like I did the right thing and told the truth." Following Katrina's testimony, the courts then heard from the two other witnesses, Steve Madoc and Tammy Sue Carlton. Steve Madoc claimed that he was sitting at home days before Celeste's murder when Celeste bursts in. He had no idea who she was, and he told her to get out, but she was screaming, quote, "They were after her." I believe this is when she escaped from the old Alice's house. He finally agreed to drive Celeste somewhere, and while driving, a van appeared and started following them. He said that there were three white females and a black male inside who kept shouting, quote, "That's her," while pointing at Celeste. Celeste was screaming and trying to hide. The van then cut off Steve's car and bumped into him a number of times, and he said, quote, "I decided right then and there I'm heading to the police department. I don't care who's doing what. I'm not involved." The van continued to chase them but disappeared after it became clear where Steve was going. There he left Celeste with the police officers. This was the incident that where LaFonce began to believe that Celeste was a police informant. So basically, she was just escaping, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Tammy Sue Carlton, the second witness, was the only maternal figure in Katrina Culbertson's life. Tammy Sue Carlton, the second witness, was the only maternal figure in Katrina Culbertson's life. Tammy testified that she had seen Katrina, Monica, and LaFonce with Celeste the day she was murdered at around 3:30 a.m. Katrina asked Tammy to go with them. Tammy could see Celeste lying on the floor of the SUV, covered in blood, and thought Katrina and Celeste had a, quote, "lover spat" and didn't want to get involved, so she declined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lover spat. She's in the backseat of the floor of an SUV covered in blood, and that's a lover spat?
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Tammy. Ugh. Tammy only began to suspect something was wrong when she heard that Celeste had been murdered. Really? Really,
yep.
Tammy?
That's when she suspected.
She's covered in blood.
Something was not right.
Right? Ugh. People. On the third day of the trial, the court heard from an FBI cellular analysis service team member. He explained the data found on LaFonce's phone showed him traveling south of Canton in the early morning hours of August 26 toward Muskegon County. It was then turned off or out of service before it popped back up in Cambridge, Ohio. His phone then headed towards Canton, arriving at around 9:40 a.m., And according to Google Maps, the journey from Muskingum County to Canton takes around 1 hour and 20 minutes when passing through Cambridge. Celeste was found dying an hour and 10 minutes before. And when you consider the time it would have taken for Celeste to free herself and crawl to the road, the timeline fits perfectly. However, the defense argued that just because LaFonce's phone traveled doesn't mean that LaFonce did, which is true, damn it, and that Katrina may have been in possession of his phone, something that seems extremely unlikely for a self-proclaimed drug dealer, which you gotta admit, they gotta...
Usually they have a couple phones, so yeah. You're not gonna leave any behind either. You could miss a call for a hookup.
Exactly. It's your family's dinner for that evening.
That's right, buddy.
Jurors were also shown crime scene photographs. As Detective Craig Knox took the stand to describe a number of items found in the scene that were submitted into evidence, some of which were a clump of human hair and burned pieces of clothing. Can't imagine being a juror on that trial either.
Absolutely not.
They'd kick me out because I'd be talking too much and yelling at the people.
You would.
The prosecution then called on Howard Kamen. He described an incident days before Celeste's death where Katrina searched his house looking for Celeste. He said after everyone had left, Katrina turned to him and said, quote, "I'm going to kill Celeste." He added, quote, "If I knew this was going to be the end of Celeste, maybe I could have done something different."
What? How much more clear do you need it?
Well, people say, oh my God, I'm going to kill her. I mean, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he might not have really thought that was a real
threat. But if
they're
kind of cruel.
Exactly.
And beat them up all the time, like they did.
Another witness, Ralph Horn, spoke of how he had woken up on Sunday morning, August 26, to realize that his SUV was missing. He hadn't given anyone permission to use it and was angry because it made him late for work. A short while later, LaFonce, Katrina, and Monica appeared at his house with the vehicle and told him he needed to clean it. Seriously? When he went
to jump to it.
When he went outside to look, he noticed the back area was covered in blood. He asked what happened, and Katrina told him that she beat her, but didn't specify who. Why didn't he go to police?
Right, so they admitted a crime, but didn't.
Right.
Unbelievable.
On Friday, day four, Monica Washington finally had her turn to tell the court her version of what happened that day. She apologized to Celeste's family, asking for forgiveness, before apologizing to her own mother. She says she was controlled by crack cocaine, describing herself as a monster who deserves to be punished. Throughout her testimony, she cried. She was visibly distressed and was shaking uncontrollably. According to newspaper reports, it was clear that she was extremely remorseful. Monica said she and Katrina set out to find Celeste that day and talked her into getting into the SUV when they spotted her in a Walmart parking lot. Monica said after LaFonce entered the car, he and Katrina looked at each other. Katrina said, quote, "You remember what we talked about?" And LaFonce replied, quote, "Yes, just tell me when." Monica said all of a sudden, LaFonce punched Celeste 3 times in the face. Monica admitted she took part in beating Celeste, who was slumped over on the floor, begging for help. Together, they wrapped a belt around Celeste's neck, and she pulled one end while LaFonce pulled the other. Monica said she then pulled up to a dirt circle where they continued their attack against Celeste, who was bleeding from her mouth, nose, and eye. Monica says Celeste didn't have the energy to fight them anymore as she was so beaten up. After moving to the recreation area, they set Celeste on fire. Then she and Katrina chanted, quote, "That's what happens to snitches," as LaFonce knelt over her, telling her she was going to die. That poor baby Celeste breaks my heart. The defense questioned why Monica had lied in her initial interviews. She addressed the jury, stating that she had lied in the past, but is sober and ready to accept responsibility. She added, quote, "LaFonce Dixon was there. LaFonce Dixon had a part in what happened to Celeste Fronsman. LaFonce Dixon is not innocent. It's time to man up and own up to your part of what happened."
I agree.
On day 5, Mark Brentz took the stand to speak about the day he found Celeste lying in the middle of the road. He is quoted saying, quote, She's got skin hanging off of her, and she just throws herself in my truck, screaming, "Help me! Help me! They're trying to kill me!" She's just totally petrified. Her face was totally burnt, just skin hanging everywhere. He says he found it difficult to understand what she was saying, but he was able to gain some understanding. He asked her name and where she was from. She told him her name was Celeste and she was from Canton. After she gave him Katrina's name, he wrote it down on a piece of paper to give to the police. He said she also mentioned Fons, Dixon, and Washington. The defense asked why he didn't write down LaFons' name and how he could have been sure that Celeste gave anyone's name if he couldn't understand what she was saying. Mark stated that he understood what Celeste said well enough to piece together a few names and parts of the story, but Celeste was in so much pain, he admitted that he thought one name would be enough for detectives to piece together what happened.
I would think so, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Mark, that's then, a starting place, you know?
Exactly. If I was burned on the side of the road and I said, my name is Jennifer, and then I mentioned Cam, I'm sure they could connect the dots to find you.
I think so.
Police are kind of smart. They can figure that out.
Yeah, I agree.
Mark then told the jury that morning after he found Celeste, he told other approaching motorists to turn back so they wouldn't have to see what he had seen.
Ugh.
Mark also stated that the smell of burnt skin will stay with him forever.
Ever. Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't go away.
Mm-mm.
The defense then called two final witnesses before they began the closing arguments. The first was Angela Wortman, the EMT who arrived at the scene at 8:47 on August 26. She said Celeste was severely burned with cuts and bruises all over her body. The worst burns were on her chest. Defense attorney Isabella Dixon asked Angela how many names she had given, and Angela replied, "Just Katrina's name." But she was more focused on caring for Celeste than gathering evidence at that time. They also brought up a forensic expert in DNA, Julie Heining, and asked, quote, "Can you say with a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that LaFons Dixon's DNA is the DNA on the roll of scotch tape?" Julie replied, quote, "No, I can say he can't be excluded, but I can't say that he is the DNA donor of the tape." That makes sense, right? She can't say that it's not him, but she can say that he's not excluded, that it could be
it's
him.
It's inconclusive, so they can't say if or if not.
Right. Closing arguments began on Wednesday, the 16th of October, somebody on this podcast's birthday, which I'm not going to mention.
Don't mention it.
No, with each side speaking to the jury for around an hour and a half. The prosecutor, Ron Welsh, showed jurors pictures of Celeste before the attack, before playing the 911 call by Mark Brutz. He asked them to close their eyes and picture the pain Celeste was in and how terrified she must have been. He said, quote, "Don't let that picture fade from your mind." He outlined the case for a final time, including all of the key pieces of evidence against LaFons. Finally, the defense argued that Monica and Katrina were framing LaFons in order to save themselves and that they murdered Celeste out of jealousy and obsessive love. They ended their argument by stating that the whole case against LaFons was built on the testimony of two liars.
Sure.
During the trial, LaFons remained quiet. He lacked any kind of emotional response. Occasionally, he would speak to his attorney. But even as the trial came to an end, his demeanor didn't change. Before the jury was sent to consider the verdict in the case, they heard from LaFons' family members, who had been in attendance throughout the whole trial. His brothers Chris and LaTroy spoke of how LaFons had taken care of them as children after the loss of their father. They described him as a good brother who played a vital part in their close-knit family. LaFons' son spoke about how his father told him to stay away from drugs and to excel in school. Those are smart words.
They are, and I wish more people would heed them.
Mm-hmm. LaFons had found out just a few years prior that his son wasn't biologically his. He still treated him as though he was his own. Finally, LaFons' mother spoke to the court. She spoke of how LaFons had taken care of his whole family after the eldest daughter had died in the house fire. His mother also had turned to cocaine use to cope with his grief, and says LaFons was totally numb because his sister was so important to him. She also insisted that LaFons was with family members the night that Celeste was attacked. don't understand parents covering for their kids. Just me don't. Neither.
We've talked about that before.
The jurors began deliberation at 3:30 p.m., and after 5 hours, they still hadn't reached a verdict and were sent home for the evening. The next day, Thursday, the 17th of October, 2013, the jury returned to court. After a further hour of deliberation, they finally reached a verdict. They found LaFons guilty of all three counts, aggravated murder, aggravated arson, and kidnapping. The jurors agreed that they did not think the death penalty was a suitable punishment given the difficulties that LaFons had already faced in life, and instead recommended that he receive life in prison. On the 4th of November, 2013, LaFons Dixon was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. He insists on his innocence, and the last day of his trial, he spoke to the jury, stating that Celeste was intelligent and beautiful, and it was a blessing he got to spend time with her. He offered his condolences to the family, but claims he was disappointed that he had been convicted on lies. He's a piece of work. The judge, Kelly Contrell, spoke directly to LaFons, telling him he was, quote, self-absorbed and self-indulgent, and lived an anything-goes lifestyle, adding, quote, you will never again have control over your life because you are going to spend the rest of your life in prison. Ms. Frosman died a horrible death at your hands.
Yes, she did.
Mm-hmm. Monica Washington was also sentenced on the 4th of November and received leniency in his sentence due to the admission of guilt and remorse she had shown. Monica was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 25 years. At sentencing, she said, quote, I am sorry for what I've done. I am sorry I didn't stop it when I had the chance. She blew a kiss to her own mother as she was led away.
They're always sorry when they get caught and after they've done it. I mean, usually, or they fake the sorry.
I think she really was. I think the other two are pieces of shit. I think Monica got wrapped up and probably wouldn't have done it if she wasn't on the crack and with the group. Does that, I think it was kind of like
totally.
A
mob mentality, but still, mm-hmm. wouldn't you be the, I don't know. I always say that. We always say that. Isn't there just one in the group that thinks, maybe this isn't a good idea. Maybe we shouldn't do this. And yet there never are.
A few days later, on November 7th, 2013, Katrina Culbertson finally stood in front of a judge ready to receive her sentence. Her attorney asked Judge Kelly Contrell to take into account Katrina's difficult upbringing, being introduced to drugs at such a young age. He asked for Katrina to be sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 41 years, given 22-year-old Katrina an eventual chance of freedom. Judge Cottrell denied the request. Katrina Culbertson was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. He said, quote, Mrs. Culbertson, you know what you did, and you knew what you did the date you signed that plea agreement. Katrina cried as she was led away in handcuffs. Celeste placed her trust in people who she loved, who she believed would keep her safe, who she knew understood her in more ways than anyone else could. These three completely took advantage of Celeste's vulnerability and preyed on her. They brutally ended her life in one of the cruelest and disturbing ways. Celeste Frosman meant so much to so many people. She was remembered as a loving mother, daughter, sister, and friend who unfortunately lost her way. They pray that she is remembered for the kind and caring person she was, not the path she had taken following the struggles and grief that she had faced. One thing is certain, Celeste's overwhelming strength and bravery throughout her life and in her last moments will always be remembered.
Wow, that was a horrible, horrible story.
It's disturbing on so...
There really is true, pure evil out there. And drugs are bad. Drugs are really bad. And I know that you do a lot of really bad things on drugs, but murdering somebody and then murdering them so brutally, it just, I can't altogether blame drugs on all of that.
I don't know what I mean. Katrina was horrible. I mean, all of them played their part in it and all of them were bad, but Katrina is pure evil. I mean, that guy's not wrong. I mean, she's evil.
Yes.
She's the one that did pour the gas. She's the one that did light her on fire. Everybody else could have stopped it. The other two could have stopped it.
Maybe they were a little scared of her,
too. Do not wish her well. Maybe. I don't know.
And they didn't want to go against her knowing
Monica maybe was, but I don't know if LaFons was. I think Katrina was pretty much wrapped around LaFonce's finger, and if LaFonce wouldn't have said and if told her to stop, I think she would have done it. But come on. I don't have the words to even describe how the mindset of Katrina. I mean, you can have a shitty life. You can be shit on. You can go through a lot of stuff, but
there's also a small part of her that I think enjoyed that.
Oh,
they like watching people suffer and things like that. So
psychopath, sociopath. What is that? What do you, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a psychologist. I don't know anything about it.
You play one on the podcast.
I don't even play one very well. Just kind of.
You play like a psychologist dropout. We'll go that way.
I play somebody that's heard the words, but really don't know what they mean quite perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's horrible. I mean, it's scary to think that there are people out there like this that just so easily could take something and
No regard for human life whatsoever.
At all. And just want to destroy it. It's just, it's heartbreaking. But in the meantime, I do want to think that was all done by Fern. She researched it. She firmed for evidence of a crime firm. One day she'll come back. She's a great lady. I truly love her. She's one of the best there is. And we thank her very much.
Great job. Sometimes when we do this podcast, you stumble upon things that are just too gruesome and too graphic. And this would be one I would probably fall down the rabbit hole. But then also, oof,
and you know what? Can I tell you, with this Gabby Petito thing going on, and seeing everybody that's jumping on it, and
you're rethinking everything, aren't you?
I'm rethinking. It's
To tell you, like I said, I was not even aware of the two other missing women. I had not heard of that. Uh-uh. And so, I don't know. I'm not it just makes much me because I
well,
can't.
But, it just makes me rethink some of the true crime community. And
yeah. Did you read that article that I'll send it to you? It was how the true crime community is going crazy over this and why they shouldn't.
Is it the Mashable one I sent you?
Yeah. Oh, maybe it was that one. Yeah. There you go. See, that's my day. It's mushed together. Mm-hmm. I just know what I see.
It just makes me rethink everything, and it makes me sad.
It's uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable.
To imagine being her family, her dad, her mom. Like, that's just, you know, to us, it's a story. It's a case. To them, this is their life.
This is
reality.
Their life.
It's
this is
horrible.
Reality.
It's horrible. So
and they're living
a
nightmare right now as we speak, and people. Like, it's all over TikTok, the poor Gabby case. And I watched one the other day that the person was saying, do you see the book that Brian's reading? It's called Annihilation, and it's about people that kidnap people and cause severe blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, okay, first of all, that book is about aliens.
Did you see the cover of it?
Yeah.
Oh, so you know. That's my point.
They were talking about, the book is about aliens, and it has absolutely nothing. Just because he's reading a book that has that subject matter does not make him thinking that he's a killer.
Yeah, there's not enough information. Well, there's just not enough information out there.
There's
just never enough information till it's out there. And as hard as it is to make predictions, especially when you think you know, sometimes you just don't. And I'll take the one on this one. So Pam Hupp, who was accused of killing Betsy Farina. I think I'm saying that I'm doing this off the cuff, so I can't remember. Well, they initially arrested her husband, and I was like, oh, he did it. He did it. Turns out he did not do it. She did it. And it took years for them to come back on that. And so I was wrong. I had it all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does happen. You just not
Well, and
to
people
say,
are saying you need to call the FBI with any tips possible. Well, you know what? If you're calling the FBI with tips of conspiracy theories, all you are doing is bogging down the information. And there could be really good tips that they need to get to, but they're going to go through your garbage first before they get to. And I'm not saying don't call in if you don't know anything, but come on. I mean, there was a body. Somebody reported a body in one of the parks that she was supposedly in. And so it took people out there looking for this body that there wasn't one. It was a spoof. Somebody called in. It was a practical joke.
Not funny.
No, it's not. It's horrible. And it pisses me off, to be quite honest.
Valuable resources should be placed elsewhere.
They should be looking for her. And then to automatically place blame on Brian, and I'm not saying that he didn't do it. I'm not saying that he did do it. We don't know. The only thing that I can tell you is I feel that he is a piece of shit because he hasn't spoken a word. He hasn't said anything, and now he's in hiding. And that makes him a piece of shit. Sorry.
Is he in the United States still?
We don't know. We have no idea where he's at. He's gone.
And you know he had to have help. And then that's just...
worse. Right.
Yes. I mean, totally worse.
He came home on the 1st of September, and nobody said anything. Didn't even tell her parents until September 11th. When her family... or didn't even tell the family anything. The family finally filed a missing persons account. 10 days. Nothing was said. And the family... mm-hmm. Pisses me off to no extent.
And from what I read, she would call home and talk to her parents at least once a day to go that 11 days. And for, and
well,
again,
it was further because I don't think they've heard from her since the 27th.
No, they
or something
haven't.
Like that.
But I mean, in that 11 days, and I'm not saying he did it, but him to come home and not alert her parents, he had to be pretty sure nobody's going to be calling home that 11 days that he was lying there at home. You see what I'm saying?
Well, and it could have been something as they could have gotten in a fight and it could have been an accident. It could have.
You know, but then just come out and say
that. She could
have
jumped out of the car and died. She could have.
That's
he could
fine.
Have
well, then
pushed
you pull
her
over
and she hit her head. It could be that she just walked out. I mean, it could have been. It could be anything. We don't know. We don't have enough
information.
That's
why we're not going to guesstimate here.
We're not speculating at all. It could be anything. We can't watch an hour-long police cam and say, oh, she's getting gaslighted. We don't know. We only see 1 hour out of their 22 years of life. We don't know. We know nothing.
Just heartbreaking. I know that for sure.
All I feel for the Petito family, and I hope she's found, and I hope everything's okay. I just got to keep looking out like that. I just can't give up hope.
I would never want to be in that position, and I hope I never am.
Exactly.
Anyway. Okay, let's wrap this up because this is a long one for us.
So anyway, thanks for sticking with us for the 3 weeks that we were off. Life happens sometimes and we apologize. We just want you to know that we did miss you terribly while we were gone. It's really weird not having an episode up. And
I will tell you my just a little glimpse into life here. And this is for all you little garage sailors out there. And you know what? It's fine. However, I never want to do one of those again in my whole life. Just a lot of work for no money. But here's my favorite. I had an exercise bike. It was really new. That tells you anything. I bought it off somebody a while ago, and I think I maybe used it twice my whole life. But it was new. It was probably $400 new, bought new. I mean, so this guy wanted it, and he said, what do you want for it? And I said, I don't know. Why don't you make me an offer? And he goes, well, I don't know. What do you want for it? And I was like, well, I really have to get rid of everything. So how about $20? And he goes, how about $10? And I said, how about 15 and I'll make my teenager load it in the car for you. And he goes, I need to make a couple phone calls. So I was like, seriously, I could get more for junk metal, scrap metal than the $10 out of that thing.
People want to make a profit or feel I like know, they got a deal, was, 20 bucks. I would have always go higher than you want, say 50. And then when they say 20,
well,
that works.
I know, but it was a... Jen, you know.
I know.
Garage sale was Saturday. I had to be out of there by Monday. So it's kind of everything must go.
I know. My husband always said, we need to do a garage sale. And I know he can run it if he wants. He loves doing that stuff. So he can do that next time he wants to. Him do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And like, just, I don't know. I can't.
Always like, let's do a garage sale. You have to get everything ready and I'll sell it. And I'm like, I don't want to get everything. You want to do the garage sale. I don't want to get anything ready.
You do it, right?
I don't want to
do
anything.
Anyway, that was my
I'm too cute to work.
I'm too cute to do a garage sale.
I'm not a domesticated housewife or I'm a domestic housewife. I'm a feral one. So there you go.
There you go. There you go. All right, Jen. I missed this. I missed all. I really was kind of excited
to miss you.
get back on the mic, if you will. So, and again, I apologize, I thank everybody for bearing with me, and yeah, it's, like I said, I'm never moving again. Honestly, I gotta tell you something, I was driving past an old folks home yesterday, and I was like, I'm kind of considering that. I was like, you know, they have
your retirement
plans.
Community, you're old
That's
enough
That's what I'm
to.
Saying.
I'm not, well, I'm I can not, only visit for a
no,
week.
No, stop it, I'm not quite that old, but I was like, you know,
you are,
cool?
It's 50. Some of them are 45.
It's 55.
Some of them are 45, I believe.
Okay, well, I don't want that kind. I want the old, I want the kind where like everybody's asleep by 8.
No, a retirement community.
That's
like
what
a
I need.
Subdivision where everybody that's older lives in, so you don't have like those meddling teenagers that, you know.
I don't know. I was thinking about
it. My mom used to live in one in Florida.
I think it might be nice. The yard's always done. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Meal plans are made for you. I don't know.
No, we're talking about two different. I'm talking to like a subdivision that's all 50 and older.
No, I'm talking old folks home where they. Oh. I have to go down to the cafeteria at 6
assisted living. You want assisted living?
No, I just want like, you know, like a bunch of condos, and I just get to live in my condo.
That's
all, with a pool and a food plan. All right, that's it. I'll let you go. Anyway, glad to be back. Missed you, Jen. Missed you guys out there. We had some stellar reviews and thank yous. So I appreciate that. That
we
like
love
I
you
said,
all.
That just makes my heart so happy. Mm-hmm. But until next Wednesday, which comes back to my turn. And the one I'm working on is people. That's all I got to tell you about that. Until then, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.